From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Three major wildfires burning in California, fueled by Santa Ana winds, are forcing tens of thousands to evacuate. There are two in Southern California, surrounding Thousand Oaks, which is still reeling from this week's mass shooting. The Woolsey Fire jumped the 101 freeway in a number of places this morning. It started south of Simi Valley and is burning in Los Angeles and Ventura counties. The Hill Fire has forced the entire communities of Oak Park and Westlake Village to evacuate. And in Northern California, the campfire has completely burned the town of Paradise, north of Sacramento. Residents quickly realizing yesterday they had to get out. Bryn Chatfield shot what's become a new genre of viral video, driving through fire and smoke that turned day into night.
Heavenly Father, please help us. Please help us to be safe.
As you see the fire burning around them, we'll have that at herenow.org. Ezra David Romero is a reporter at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Ezra, people are posting other videos talking about their cars catching on fire as they raced out. Describe what happened.
Yeah, the fire started about 6:30 in the morning yesterday. And it, you know, this is an area of oak woodland that's a mixed conifers and a lot of dry grass. So a fire that ignites in an area like this can just start burning really fast and grow really large. And that's what happened. The fire started at 6:30, and then in a couple hours, it was 5,000 acres and just kept growing and growing and growing. And plus all the wind speeds, there was wind speeds between 34 and 50 miles an hour. And that wind event just kept going on and spread this fire. And within 24 hours this morning, you know, it grew to 70,000 acres.
Right. And of course, you know, we remember the horrific car fire not too far away. And so these people, once they realized, we're hearing stories of people running down highways, abandoning their cars. Do we know of any casualties?
At this point, there was a Cal OES meeting this morning, and they said there have been injuries and some fatalities, but they're not releasing any information yet. People were leaving their cars, and then fire crews were having to move cars out of the way to get fire trucks into places like Paradise. And a reporter we have there this morning in this place called Paradise said, you know, one thing that's only standing is Taco Bell. And that's sort of the scene you have. It's like everything is destroyed,
it's gone.
Cal Fire reports about 80% of the town is gone.
Meanwhile, an evacuation warning was issued last night for parts of the city of Chico. So what's the latest there?
Yeah, so far Cal Fire says they've done burn operations on where the fire is approaching Chico. So they light fire and to create this like barrier right between the city and the fire. They say the fire is moving north. And right now there was a red flag warning for this area. That's gone away. But the conditions are still so dry and severe here that with such low humidity in the air that even without that red flag warning, sparks could still fly and, you know, embers could push this fire on.
Yeah, and remind us, red flag, what is that telling residents?
A red flag warning is where there's high winds, there's low humidity in the air. It's saying all the conditions are right, that if a fire sparks, it can grow really big and really bad.
Yeah. And meanwhile, two other serious fires burning in the southern part of the state. Nerves must be on edge.
Yeah, you know, we're in November 9th, right? Mm-hmm. We've had not much rain in October, and there's not much forecast in the coming days as well. So I think the whole state is really on alert, and this has sort of been the story year after year now in California.
Yeah. Ezra David Romero, reporter at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California. And Ezra, just one last thought. We talked about people waking up to this fire and in Paradise and fleeing. Do they feel they got enough in a few seconds we have? Were they told to evacuate?
From what I hear, no. But they say, you know, this because it happened
so fast.
The fire grew so fast, there just wasn't time to alert everyone in that timely manner.
Boy, Ezra, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there are still a handful of midterm races that are undecided. In Arizona, the Democratic candidate for Senate, Kristen Sinema, has taken a narrow lead over Republican Martha McSally, with still hundreds of thousands of ballots uncounted. In Georgia's governor's race, the campaign for Democrat Stacey Abrams is promising to sue if all votes aren't counted. Republican Brian Kemp says he won a clear victory. And in Florida, Republican Rick Scott leads by just 15,000 votes. He's trying to unseat Democratic Senator Bill Nelson. In the governor's race, Republican Ron DeSantis leads Democrat Andrew Gillum by more than 30,000 votes. Steve Contorno is national political correspondent for the Tampa Bay Times. He's in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So let's start with the Senate race. Today, Democratic Senator Bill Nelson's campaign announced a lawsuit against the Florida Secretary of State. What happened?
Yeah, it appears that they have already laid the groundwork to raise some issues about how the ballot approval process works, specifically requirements that signatures must match those on file with the state. And they make the case that this disproportionately disenfranchises otherwise legitimate ballots, and it leads to throwing away people who voted accurately and fairly.
And when you say signatures, you're talking about mail-in ballots, people who mailed them in and then they had to sign, and then there's somebody actually checking to see if their signature matches up with their signature.
Correct. It's mail-in ballots and also provisional ballots. If you don't show up with an ID or if you show up at the wrong polling place, you can file a provisional ballot. You sign an affidavit and they check that against what your signature on file with the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Meanwhile, yesterday, the Republican candidate, Governor Rick Scott, announced a lawsuit against Broward and Palm Beach counties as he has been watching his lead get slimmer. What is he saying?
He's raising a lot of issues about the transparency in those two offices. He is concerned about the fact that they are still counting votes at this time while all other counties have finished the majority of election day and pre-election votes. I'm not sure what the end result of this litigation can be because this process is supposed to wrap up by Saturday. And if this was more of an attempt to raise red flags and create a lot of more uncertainty about the outcome of what's coming out of those particular counties.
Why is there so much trouble in some of these counties in counting the votes? Why can't they count the votes as quickly, for example, in Broward County as they have in the other counties of the state?
That's a great question. It's one that we've wondered time and time again in elections in Florida. Broward County seems to habitually have issues. It is a very large county, and it's one of the most populous counties in the state. Administering election of that size is difficult. And they technically have until Saturday to get their results in. So they're saying, we are just doing our due diligence to take the time that's allotted to us to finish.
So if things stay about where they are right now, both the Senate race and the governor's race would require a recount.
Correct. It's sort of unprecedented. We haven't had a statewide recount in either of those races, and it's going to require a lot of manpower and a lot of hours to get that done, and we won't have an outcome for several weeks.
And at least the Senate race would require actually a manual recount, not just a machine recount.
Yeah, and that's critical because there is an issue in the Senate race that is not present in the governor's race, and that is in Broward County, there are about 30,000 undervotes in the Senate race. And what I mean by that is that about 30,000 ballots did not vote in the Senate race, which is the top race on the ballot. And that phenomenon was only present in that part of the state. So it's the lawyers for Nelson believe that this is a result of a machine error or markings on the ballot that may have messed up the count. And if this goes to a recount, they believe that those 30,000 undervotes will be remedied and they will fall heavily in Bill Nelson's favor because this is an overwhelmingly Democratic county.
And what about in the governor's race? Also appears to be headed toward a recount. Ron DeSantis, the Republican, has seen his lead shrinking over Andrew Gillum. Is it possible that that race is going to change in terms of the outcome?
I think you're going to see the results continue to narrow because a lot of counties are just now finishing counting provisional ballots, and provisional ballots overwhelmingly trend toward Democrats. However, it's a much larger gap for him to overcome. There is not the undervote issue in the governor's race that is present in the Senate race. It does not seem to have the same path to a flip as we've seen in the Senate race, as well as the another statewide race, the agriculture commissioner race, which already has flipped toward the Democrat.
Everybody, as they watch this, is thinking about 2000 and the presidential election in 2000 and the recount and the hanging chads and all that stuff. Is that part of the conversation there in Florida, or do you just look at this and say, wow, we really live in a divided state?
I don't think election goes by where people aren't thinking about 2000 in Florida anymore. It seems that there's always something that you know, happens that goes, oh no, not again. And usually it's eye rolling and or it's just, you know, over precaution. But this year we're actually seeing it. And that is obviously the most notorious recount in probably U.S. history. And yet this recount that we're headed toward is even more unprecedented because there are going to be three statewide recounts as well as three recounts in legislative races as well. So 2000 obviously drew a lot of national attention and it will go down in infamy. But this one is going to be noteworthy in its own right for a long time.
I will take it a step further than you and say that is definitely the most notorious recount in American history. Steve Contorno, national political correspondent for the Tampa Bay Times. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I can still see that guy looking through the ballot, you know, with his magnifying glass to see if the Chad was hanging or not. Ugh.
Time now to see how the news filtered through social media this week. And what a week. An election, a mass shooting, wildfires. Let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Robin.
And we know social media is lit up with thoughts about the shooting, the mass shooting in Thousand Oaks. 20-year-old Matt Wennerstrom lived, and here he is speaking with reporters on the night of the shooting.
We hid behind a pool table until we heard a break in the shots. And at that point, we jumped up, and I watched one of my friends throw a bar stool through the window. And then I followed suit, and a couple other people were able to break the glass down. And then we just, everyone piled right out the window.
And before that, he said, we got everyone behind that pool table and down. And then there was probably six or seven of us guys dogpiling over the girls that were
laying
beneath
on top
us.
Of each other to stop them from getting hit by bullets.
Yeah, what are people saying?
Well, Matt's story got out there because of the various news reporting and interviews that were being done, and people didn't actually know who he was. So before people knew his name, they were saying, this guy is amazing. He's giving us a way to, what should we do in an emergency situation? And there were screen grabs of him. He's got a grey shirt on, and there's blood on his shirt, not his blood, but other people's blood. James Shaw Jr. sums it up on Twitter. As weird as this sounds, says James, and trust me, I know, thank you, Matt Wennerstrom, for what you did, keeping your head straight and saving lives. And Ron Hellas, for your ultimate sacrifice, praying for your family. He uses this hashtag, not all heroes wear capes. And Ron Hellas was the Ventura County Sheriff's Sergeant who was killed in that shooting.
Yeah.
And then a number of other people were saying, we should make Matt Wennerstrom's name go viral and not the name of the shooter. And then just some pushback on Facebook, because this conversation always broadens out, Robin, as you know. Whenever we have mass shootings in the US, people start asking about gun control. On Facebook, Haley Ribber says, hate me all you want, but this is a good reason to be licensed to carry. And then, of course, we get into the normal gun control conversation, which I'm not going to get into today.
Well, but I think it's, well, and you know, it's playing out, but I think it's so interesting that people are saying, share Wennerstrom's name and not the shooter's name. We are not using the shooter's name to give it infamy. But they're also saying, share Telemachus Orfanos' name. He was the young man who survived the Las Vegas shooting but was killed in the country music bar. His parents have both spoken out and talked about gun control. So this is all in the mix there, and very powerful. Then there's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Yesterday, the 85.
Who is also very powerful.
Very powerful, but a little less so after she fell and apparently was hospitalized, breaking some ribs. NPR's Nina Totenberg has heard from the Supreme Court that Justice Ginsburg is out of the hospital, working from home today. But before that, what were people doing online?
So thank you for the health update via Nina. So I'm checking up on the mental health of Justice Ginsburg fans on Twitter, and they had a number of creative suggestions from stopping her hurting herself again. Paige on Twitter says, I will volunteer my fat, which will keep from further breakage. that's quite an ugly picture. Thanks, Paige, for that. Clark Oliver is suggesting, I'm just going to tweet this just a little bit so it's suitable for broadcasting.
Okay.
Why is Ruth Bader Ginsburg not being toted around on a chaise by 12 muscle-bound men like the Queen of Sheba? Why not indeed?
Stephen Colbert said she should be wrapped in plastic and carried like a Fabergé egg. But others, there's the hashtag ribs for RBG.
Yes. And so those are suggestions of people saying, I will actually give my rib to help her out. And all of this, it's sort of panic slash anxiety attack slash humor. But I also looked under RBJ4, and that's also going around online. And there's a more serious conversation underlying the jokes. And Ken Webster Jr. says, is it time for the notorious RBG to step down? Yeah. And then David Russell says one more thing, which I think is really important here. He says RBG is 85 years old. She should be able to fall and break a bone without an entire democracy breaking as a result.
Well, and of course, people worry that she's holding a seat that's moderate to left-leaning, and in this administration.
Of course, that's behind everything and all of the memes and all of the jokes.
I just have to mention Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, who was narrowly ousted by the Democrat Tony Evers on Tuesday, has been getting a lot of attention because it was his law that he signed in 2016 that's preventing him from asking for a recount, and that of course is all over social media as well.
Lots of karma memes, and I think Scott Walker's been reading some of them. He tweeted out earlier on today, be strong and courageous, don't be afraid or scared of them. He's definitely reading Twitter here. For the Lord your God himself is he who goes with you. He will not fail you. That's Deuteronomy 31:6. So I think he has definitely been reading the tweets that are making fun of his signing the law, which means that now he can't go for a recount.
Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Well, as the midterm results came in, so did the jokes. Stephen Colbert, Seth Meyers, Jimmy Kimmel, Trevor Noah all hosted their shows live on Tuesday night. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to talk about the midterms on late night TV. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So back in 2016, hosts like Stephen Colbert reacted to Trump's victory live, but this was very different. What was the atmosphere like on late night TV this time around?
Well, you know, what was interesting was I felt the live shows on 2016 were a little more interesting because it was such a shock. This time around, the full impact of all the races wasn't really known. And so they didn't really have anything to react to. What we did know, what they did know at that time, was stuff that their audience would like, that the Democrats were likely to take control of the House, for example. So what we were left with were the kinds of jokes that they probably would have told even if they had pre-taped the show. And so we've got a clip of Stephen Colbert telling a joke about Ted Cruz. And if you listen to that, you can get a sense of what I'm talking about.
Then again, why wouldn't Ted Cruz win in Texas? Because at the end of the day, real cowboys only love three things: barbecue, rodeo, and Canadians who went to Princeton and Harvard. So, once again, Ted Cruz defeats Beto O'Rourke. Although, by not being Ted Cruz, Beto still a winner.
So you could imagine a couple of words tweaked in that bit, and he could have told that joke even not knowing who had won that race. And so Colbert in particular announced a lot of results during his show. But I sort of felt like if you were interested in those results, you would have been watching cable television. And, you know, when I watched Jimmy Kimmel, for example, he was live. I felt like much of that show could have been taped in advance and I never would have known.
There were a lot of parallels between the different shows. Some satirized newscasters' graphics. Others used alcohol as a prop. What stood out to you?
Well, okay, even though I dinged Jimmy Kimmel Live a little bit, he did what I thought was one of the coolest things, where he got Sacha Baron Cohen to pretend to be one of his legendary characters, Borat, and go around and talk to people and try to draw out some of their most ridiculous ideas about politics. And in fact, we've got a clip of that. Let's check it out.
Here, these nasty fake news people say that Donald Trump is bad to immigrant children. We hear that he keep the Mexican children in cages. It's true. Yeah. High five.
So many came over here. They had to be somewhere.
Have to cage them.
So he got some average person, just went up to her house and engaged her in conversation and got her to react that way. And so that was a great bit. But again, that was something that was filmed in advance and could have been done without this show being live. But that was an awesome bit and fell, I think, at just the right moment, airing during his show on election eve.
Okay, so the midterms are over, and now I want to talk to you about something else that you told me at the end. So Eric and I, after we do our conversations, we like to chat a little bit about other shows Eric's watching, because every time he has put me onto something. It is always really good. And you told me to watch Bodyguard on Netflix, and I did. And I want to play a little clip of this. This is a British drama that was on the BBC, but it just arrived on Netflix last month. It's about a cop tasked with protecting the Home Secretary in the UK. Opens with an intense 20 minutes. We see war veteran David Budd, played by Richard Madden, who you probably know from Game of Thrones, trying to talk down a suicide bomber on a train with his kids in the next car. Here it is.
My name's David. David Budd. What's yours?
Nadia.
The man that was in here before. Is that your husband? Yeah? And your husband wants you to die? You don't have to be a martyr, Nadia. We can deactivate this device.
Eric, this has the suspense of like 24 or some of these other shows. It's really well done.
Yeah, you know, we have this character who's sort of the flawed hero where the viewer can see all of his virtues, but the rest of the characters can mostly see his flaws. So this is someone who's suffering from PTSD, so his marriage is falling apart. He manages to react courageously when he's in emergency situations. So he resolves this incident with the bomber, but a lot of things happen to the character to make everyone else doubt him. And so the whole arc of the storyline is about, are his instincts right? Is he on the mark? Is he paranoid? Has he been distracted by his PTSD? And the show is six episodes, and the story, I think, fills those episodes pretty well. And it was a phenomenon in Britain. It was kind of water cooler show that we rarely see on television anymore.
You know, I kind of like the idea of six-episode shows. It's not that big of a commitment.
Yeah.
And if it's bad, you haven't wasted that much time.
Well, British TV used to be like that. And I don't know if there's a deal to do another season of Bodyguard. Certainly, it's so successful, I would be surprised if they did. But there would be some value in just saying, you know what, we told the story we needed to tell. We can just let that sit and let that be an excellent series of television. I hope they do that.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And check out Bodyguard. You will like it.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The markets have been jittery today after oil prices took a dive yesterday. Two benchmarks are now around 20% lower than they were a month ago. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what is happening with oil prices?
Well, yeah, Jeremy, getting the supply and demand balance in the oil market is notoriously difficult. Just at the beginning of last month, oil was at a four-year high above $76 a barrel. And a big reason for that was a couple things. For one, things are a mess in Venezuela, which is a big producer. But more importantly, President Trump had ripped up the Iran deal that was reached under the Obama administration. And he was preparing new sanctions that would cut off Iranian crude from global markets. So that sort of spurred the prices to go up to that four-year high. But at the same time, other producers like Saudi Arabia started producing more oil to make up for that lost supply. And then the U.S. ended up exempting some big buyers like India and China and South Korea from the actual Iranian sanctions. So it sort of wreaked havoc on the whole supply-demand balance, and that's why we're looking at these huge losses now.
It's still a 20% drop in about a month is pretty significant.
It is, yeah. I would point out that the oil's a lot more volatile than, say, the stock market. Big drops like this are more frequent than, say, a 20% drop in stocks, and then big rebounds as well.
What does this mean for the American oil industry?
Well, you know, the American oil industry is, if you step back a few years, it's been booming. We've had these record low interest rates after the recession, and that created this massive investment in oil drilling in the U.S. And at the same time, we had this new technology, fracking and horizontal drilling, and that was brought online at the same time, and it allowed drillers to access crude that was more or less off limits before. So that's a big part of the reason why prices came down aggressively, say, in 2015, 2016. Remember, their oil was trading in the 20-something a barrel
right.
in 2016. And then the balance sort of corrected itself and it crept back up. So, you know, it's this supply-demand balance that is sort of always in play in the market.
I always notice that when oil prices go up, gas prices follow very quickly. When oil prices go down, it takes a while for the gas prices to come down.
That's right. That's right. Obviously, you know, it takes a while. Because of these sudden drops like this, you know, gasoline suppliers might be slow to adjust. They're not going to want to give up those profits right away.
So you say that, you know, these things happen, the oil market is volatile. But when you look back at the historic chart of oil prices, you look at one of the biggest drops was right before the Great Recession. Should we be worried about that this could lead to other problems?
Well, yeah. Since the U.S. has become such a big producer of oil, it's not an unequivocal good thing when it drops because there's a lot of jobs, a lot of investments tied to oil in the country now. And you're right. Looking back at the recession, the oil market went bonkers. It crashed about 35% from before the recession, from mid-2006 right. to early 2007. Then in the middle of the recession, it actually shot up to $145 a barrel in the middle of 2008. Right. And that's because everyone was bailing out of bank stocks and other equities and getting into oil instead. And then by the end of 2008, it was back in the 30s. So it really did sort of add to the issues weighing on the economy during the recession.
They didn't have Bitcoin to flee to at that point. Mike Regan, thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
There is a widespread view that fundamentalist faiths, branches that follow the letter of the religious law, are incompatible with LGBTQ, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or questioning lives. And that's largely true. Last week, Israel's parliament rejected a bill that would allow gay couples access to surrogacy to start families. Ultra-Orthodox members of the governing coalition wouldn't allow it. A few months earlier, an ultra-Orthodox Jewish member of Israel's parliament was forced to resign after revealing he attended his nephew's same-sex wedding. Of course, Jewish Orthodoxy isn't the only fundamentalist group that rejects homosexuality, but we're focusing on it today because we're talking to an outlier, ultra-Orthodox Rabbi Mike Moskowitz, who has come out not as gay, but as an LGBTQ ally, which cost him jobs, friends, and brought him a lot of hate mail. But Rabbi Moskowitz, you've also said you think this is what a holy decision.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we're all put in this world for a specific purpose. And for me, I've found clarity in the invitation to kind of expand the space that religion, I think, is meant to provide as a container to help support relationships with God. And there's just a huge segment of society that is being told there's no room for you here. And as a fundamentalist, I believe that God is everywhere all the time. And so we need some restorative religion to heal for some of the trauma that has been meted out by those who want to constrict the space that God occupies.
You just said something that I had never thought of in that way. Religion as a container to support a relationship with God. So you're saying that if religion prohibits a part of the person to be in that container, they're not really having that relationship with God.
I think that God is in some sort of prefabricated, mass-produced space. And each person needs to ask themselves, what does God want from me being who I am in this relationship?
Look, we want to rush to say that we're talking about Judaism. We just happen to be because you are Jewish. But all of Judaism doesn't reject homosexuality. The Reform movement actually embraces the LGBTQ movement. Conservative Judaism also allows for same-sex marriages. Some modern Orthodox communities are also taking some small steps in that direction. But you are ultra-Orthodox. First of all, what does that mean to you?
I find it helpful to borrow language from the queer community about my own religious identity because I think there's a huge parallel there. So I was assigned secular and then kind of came out as Orthodox in high school, went on a right-wing trajectory for the next 20 years, learning in the largest seminaries in the world and really living in that very far right-wing Lithuanian yeshiva world. And now identify as religiously nonconforming. I have very progressive values, which are very much a part of who I am. I also am deeply religious. we all have to express ourselves with some sort of dominant physical form. And so for me, living in an ultra-Orthodox community, dressing the way in which rabbis in my community dress is helpful in that it expresses to the world who I am at my core. And if we force somebody to choose between a gender identity and a religious identity, or a sexual identity and a religious identity, there's only one out of those three, which is a choice. And so people leave religion because they're told that there's no space for them to be who they are.
You say people don't choose to be either gay or lesbian or trans. Look, I said that you said that this new understanding you have, you feel is a holy understanding. And I understand it came to you with a personal experience?
That's correct. Actually, two different personal experiences that really led me in this quest to try to uncover and discover the divine will. First, someone in my family transitioned and said, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy. And that led me, as I was a rabbi at Columbia University, to explore gender studies for the first time. And then when one of my students was really struggling as a trans individual, I felt a calling to really come out very publicly as an ally, because the rabbinic voice, I don't think, has been loud enough in creating a safe space, that a sanctuary should be a sacred space, a sanctuary from persecution. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, religion now often excludes people.
Your synagogue in Harlem became the first trans-friendly traditional synagogue, but you were still kind of quiet about your support of the community. And then gave a speech at Hanukkah at the Old Broadway Synagogue. And that, you call that your coming out speech, becoming public about being an ally.
For me, it felt so reminiscent of the feeling I had when I was 17, 20 years earlier, thinking about whether or not I was willing to kind of take on the precarity of acknowledging a truth that I felt in my core to be absolute and objective, but was going to have consequences.
You mean what? About becoming ultra-Orthodox, accepting
as
a religion?
Yeah. And it was a similar struggle at 37 to come out again in that place of embarking on a journey to discover and uncover the divine will in a space that was very new for me. I think faith is a call to action. And when we're willing to do something in partnership with God for the greater good, and there's risks involved, I think that there's a way in which we manifest the divine will in the world of action.
Well, but not everyone agreed in that moment, and you lost your job. You have taken up other advocacy work, but do you feel a little bit in the wilderness?
It's lonely and isolating in that this space isn't occupied with other people with my background. And I think that's just the way it is when it comes to progress. But we also have some old truths that we can ground ourselves in, which are that God loves us more than we love ourselves, and God doesn't put extra people in this world, and God so desperately yearns and longs to be in relationship with each one of us. And unfortunately, the suicide rate among, you know, the trans community, for those who are not validated and affirmed, it's over 40%. Mm-hmm. And so whether we understand the meta question of where gender lies is almost irrelevant, because we do understand the practical obligation to create a safe space for folks.
Yeah. Well, you being in the wilderness and feeling outside of, has, I'm sure, given you even more empathy than you already had for this community, and they need it. Earlier this year, we interviewed Chavi Weisberger, who spent years fighting for her kids. She came out as a lesbian. They were taken away. She lost her entire extended family. I'm sure you hear stories like that.
Every day. And as a straight, white, cis male, for me, on a bad day, is still much more privileged than most trans folks on a good day. There is a lot of work to be done. And if we want to create a space where everybody is welcome, then we can't marginalize or exclude anybody.
Do you think things might shift? I mean, there was a statement released in 2010 by a faculty member at the liberal Orthodox school saying that it couldn't sanction homosexuality but should welcome gay people as full members of the community. Do you see this shifting even further?
At the intersection of tradition and innovation, there is a lot of tension. If you change the rules too much, it's a different game. But if you don't adapt, no one's going to show up to play. And I think the far right part of Orthodoxy has drawn some lines with Sharpies, very permanent lines. But The problem is that that no longer fits the topography of the universe. And as rabbis were taught not to answer questions, but to answer people. And so the needs of people today are just different. So we don't need to change the tradition, but we need to recognize that its application to people needs to look different because people look different.
What do you say to the people who, to them, it's desecration? That's the same in fundamentalist Christianity. There's a strong belief that it is against God's will. It's an abomination.
Sure. So nobody can ever own the relationship of another with God. And I think that we need to have much more autonomy given to the individual to own and take responsibility for our relationships with God. You know, when we have rabbis getting in between a person's relationship with God, it gets crowded. If a person is genuinely and sincerely on a quest to discover the divine intention, that struggle for truth is as holy as it gets.
By the way, and it's also occurring to me as I speak with you, that you had your transcendent moment through meeting transgendered people. The words were so much alike.
Yes. We find transitions deep within our tradition, from holiness to the mundane, from the day into the night. And sometimes it's a contradiction to the physical, because that plane of spirituality might look different than what we see with our physical eyes. Then if we have gendered aspects of God in our liturgy, our Father, our King, and feminine aspects, and God doesn't have a body, so then where might gender lie? And what might that tell us about those who are able to kind of sense things perhaps on a soul level?
That is ultra-Orthodox Rabbi Mike Moskowitz, one of only a handful of ultra-Orthodox Jewish clergy advocating for the LGBTQ community as a straight man. Rabbi Moskowitz, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A lot of women won elections on Tuesday, mostly Democratic women, but also Republicans like Marsha Blackburn, who won a Senate seat in Tennessee. Chaz Sisk is senior editor for WPLN in Nashville. Chaz, you followed Blackburn's career for some time. Has she always had her eyes on the Senate?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to say whether she's had her eyes on the Senate precisely, but she's definitely always been a very ambitious politician. This goes back to when she first got elected to the state legislature in the 1990s. She seemed to be immediately positioning herself for a run at Congress or something like that. In 2014, she was putting out feelers in New Hampshire as maybe a dark horse candidate for president before really who the field was going to be had taken shape. And there was some talk in 2016 of her maybe being Trump's running mate before Mike Pence was chosen. So she's definitely always been very ambitious in terms of her aspirations.
And there was a big question about whether she would be able to actually win this race. She was going up against a very popular former governor, Democrat Phil Bredesen, but she ended up beating him by 10 points. What do you think made that happen?
Well, you have to remember that Tennessee leans very heavily Republican, and so there's a very high built-in advantage for the Republican nominee. She won by nationalizing this election and really being very unrelenting in her attacks on Phil Bredesen, the Democratic nominee. So that strategy paid off for her in the end.
She's been in the House of Representatives since 2003. What kind of legislation has she sponsored or supported in that time?
You know, she's not really known so much as being a sponsor of legislation as being a spokeswoman for Republican positions. A lot of your listeners may be familiar with her through her appearances on Sunday morning talk shows and on cable news over the years. And to the extent that her legislative record is known in Tennessee, they've often been things that don't help her with the voters. She was opposed to the FCC's net neutrality rules. She's also been attacked during the campaign about sponsoring some opioid legislation that law enforcement said made it harder for them to crack down on overprescribers. But what she does have is a talent for spotting positions that are going to resonate with conservative voters and just really being a great spokeswoman for those issues.
Well, and as an example of that, we were in Tennessee doing the show from Nashville a couple years ago in 2016 in the early part of the presidential campaign back in February of 16 when President Trump was not the nominee of the party yet. Nobody knew what was going to happen with that. And I remember being at an event with Marsha Blackburn, a straw poll in Williamson County near Nashville. It was not clear if Trump was going to be the nominee, but I asked Blackburn if she would be okay with any of the 17 Republican candidates being the nominee, and here's what she said.
You better believe it. I'm going to be working full steam ahead for whomever is the nominee. The goal is to beat the Democrats and to take control of the White House.
Even if it's Donald Trump, you'll work full steam ahead for him.
Absolutely. Whomever is our nominee, I'm going to be with them all the way through Election Day and making certain that we are victorious and we have a Republican in the White House.
So it's interesting to hear her say that at that point, because at that time, a lot of Republicans were sort of staying away from Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's a good, very good example of sort of how Marsha Blackburn works. I mean, she understood very early in 2016, maybe not in that first group of Republicans, but certainly in the second group of Republicans in Congress, that Donald Trump was really resonating with a lot of voters in places like Tennessee. It really shows her talent for sort of spotting where the Republicans and where conservative voters are going.
What about the fact that she's going to be the first woman to represent Tennessee in the U.S. Senate? Did she talk about that as part of her campaign?
Not very much, really. The only time I can really think of it coming up in the campaign was when there was some speculation that her high negatives were going to keep her from winning the general election, and people were urging Bob Corker to run for re-election, reverse his decision to retire. A spokeswoman for Blackburn referred to him to people who were advocating for Corker to return to the race as sexist pigs. One thing about Blackburn is that she's always insisted on being called congressman in an office. It's something that strikes a lot of people, even in Tennessee, as anachronistic. But, you know, she quipped on election night that people who were against that or who were bothered by that, now they could just call her senator from now on.
Right.
Exactly. Easier. So, you know, that's really her only nod to the glass ceiling and breaking the glass ceiling in this election.
What about issues? Let's listen to a little bit of what Marsha Blackburn said about the issues that resonated most with Tennessee voters.
Constitutional judges. People are pleased that Kavanaugh is on the bench. We hear a lot about tax cuts because the economy is just booming in Tennessee. Tax cuts are working. And people remember I led the battle against the state income tax.
She's also talked about her support for a wall along the border with Mexico. Is there a signature issue that you identify her with?
That reference to taxes is to some extent it. But the fact is that she really portrayed herself throughout this campaign, and I think she is seen in Tennessee as a reliable vote for the Republican agenda nationwide. So no real signature issue, but I think certainly people feel very confident that she's going to vote on the Republican agenda the way they want them to.
You think that she has aspirations beyond the Senate?
The old saw is that every congressman looks in the mirror and sees a senator, and every senator looks in the mirror and sees a president.
Right.
I think that she's a very ambitious politician. I wouldn't be surprised if she ran for something like that. But on the other hand, she is 66 years old. She's getting towards the tail end of her political career, so there's not much of a window there.
66. It's common to be 85 or more in the Senate these days.
Yeah, that's certainly true. It's a tough game running for president, and it's really up to her whether she wants to do that or not. But certainly she's flying very high in Tennessee right now.
That's Chaz Sisk, senior editor for WPLN in Nashville. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.